Hello again, my friends. So happy to be back with you. And tonight we'll continue our conversation from last week, focusing on how to configure bringing compassion into clinical work. And I was reflecting before class tonight that as with love, of course, there are as many ways to manifest compassion and make efforts to bring it into clinical work as there are clinicians. So these are just some primary insights and methods that have been helpful for me in my clinical work. And so tonight, I'll talk with you about some of Bernie Brandschaft's work. And I'll also say a few words about my chapter from Joe's wonderful anthology, Advances in Contemplative Psychotherapy. And if we perhaps start with Brandschaft, the chapter that I offered you comes from a really fantastic book called Toward an Emancipatory Psychoanalysis. It's a mouthful, this title, but the book is really, I think, exceptional in laying out with great specificity, but also a lot of heart, how to really enter into a client or a patient's psychological suffering that they're trying to work through in therapy. And so even for people who are not psychodynamic clinicians, or for those of you who are not clinicians, your teachers, I think the insights are so worthwhile. And for me, they really do all circle around the call to be compassionate, that they're all circling around the need to, as fully as possible, understand another person's suffering and find effective ways of responding. And this is basically what we're doing when we feel compassion, is we are trying to orient toward another human being's experience of suffering. We're not having to split off from our own, but to some extent, we're having to table the centrality of our own suffering to really feel in a visceral way that another person's suffering is as critically important as anyone else's, and certainly as critically important as our own. And it's for this reason that clinical work is really a spiritual practice, because we are consistently tabling our own suffering. Of course, we might be using our suffering to find parallel experiences, right, as a way of stepping into the suffering of the other. But clinical work, you could think of as a practice of tonglen all day long, right? I'm really going to open the mind and the heart to what somebody else has lived through and is trying to now work through with me. And I have gained a great deal of insight from Brandschaft. And so I want to just share a couple of the key points that he lifts up in all of these chapters, but this is a chapter that I find to be very helpful in summarizing some of the main themes. And some of them we touched on last week in Bromberg's work. But as a starting point, Brandschaft wanted to suggest that patients who find themselves in psychotherapy are trying to work out a process of self-articulation and self-differentiation. Now, this might sound at odds with a Buddhist understanding of healing, right? But this is not a process of getting fixated on self so much as discovering oneself. And so Branchoff really wants to lay out what needs to happen either developmentally or later in adulthood in order for people to differentiate, discover and differentiate themselves from another. And he suggests that this is, of course, it's a complex developmental process because of our profound need for others, and certainly in early life, right? As I've talked about with you before, we really do have this existential need for a caregiver because we are not viable, because we depend on others for everything, right? For food, for basic safety, for love, for care of all kinds. We early in life experience caregivers as being really ultimate reflectors of reality, including ultimate reflectors of our reality, our subjective reality. And what makes this complex is that we have this experience before we have a reflective function, right? Before we have any consciousness that this is happening. And so Branchoff is really trying to explain that we all evolve out of this pre-reflective state in which we are internalizing the reflection of the other, right? The perception of our caregivers of who we are and who we are becoming. And that young children will forsake their own authentic self-experience in order to align with who the caregiver is experiencing them as being or who the caregiver needs them to be. Yeah. Now, what's really very interesting about this and worth thinking about, this is something that I find myself coming back to again and again, is that in adulthood, often our most tenacious beliefs about who we are help us sustain a feeling of connection, of psychic, visceral, right, deeply embedded connection to our caregivers, regardless of the quality of that connection. Right, regardless of the nature of the attachment history, whether it was very loving and secure or highly inconsistent and anxious or outright traumatic and therefore very disorganizing, Branchoff wants to say that often what happens is we hold on to these beliefs about who we are that were reflected by our caregivers in order to sustain an archaic tie to them. And I have really found this to be so. I mean, I've shared with you that most of my patients are in their 70s and 80s. Some are older than that. And I find that the terror of the psychic loss is so abiding, it is so entrenched, that this is what Branchoff wants us to try to work with. This is where he wants us to orient our compassion, really to try to notice, you know, what's in that self-experience that is seemingly almost impossible to relinquish because it would mean differentiating from the original caregiver in some way that feels like an unbearable loss. Yeah. So this is something that he's working on in his chapter with William, right? Where William has internalized a feeling of badness, a feeling of being by his nature burdensome to others, because he's going to need something from others. If they don't give it to him, he's going to erupt with frustrated rage, which is going to confirm his feeling that he is by his nature burdensome to others, and on it goes. But what he and Branchaft were working out were the roots of that feeling of being burdensome by nature, of having needs, and the feeling of badness that got woven into his psyche that he's having a very hard time relinquishing. And not just because of the defenses against getting into the unconscious material. This is where Branchaft was really opening up a psychodynamic understanding of human suffering. He's saying this is not just about working through defenses. This is really working toward understanding what's in that deeply felt tie. What is at risk, and beginning to challenge it, to soften it. So as a way of just understanding that process, he brings us back into William's early experience and lays out how if there's a dissonance between the child's authentic self experience and what's reflected back to them, there are these chronic, profound levels of doubt and difficulty in trusting one's own perception. Yeah. And this is of course a central part of what he's trying to work out with William. And so the method is one of really cultivating deep curiosity for what the patient is authentically feeling and experiencing, as a way of helping them trust their own perception. Right, so he's in some ways trying to help William feel his way back into his authentic self experience that got enshrouded by a distorted perception, right, of his caregivers. And then to see if he can cultivate, right, that trustworthy perception and have that become his organizing principle rather than, you know, distorted reflections offered by others. So he's doing all this to see if he can help William start to trust that he can bring who he authentically is into relationship, right? This came up last week, but it's sometimes one of the most powerful unconscious beliefs that people need to work through in therapy, that in order to sustain authentic relationship to themselves, they have to stay outside of relationship. In order to get the fruits of relationship, they have to forsake who they authentically are. So the psychodynamic method is one of just lifting that organizing principle or that belief to awareness so that it can be worked with. Yeah, it can be more consciously related to, explored, rather than wielding power because it's remaining unconscious. Now, in order for that to happen, a patient would need to really bolster their reflective function, right? Really bolster their ability to hold in their own mind awareness of their experience and begin to think about it, to mentalize it. And that, of course, has, you know, it has some elements of mindfulness. It has some elements of that spacious attention in which evaluating mind, the conceptual mind is somewhat relaxed, but it would also have the psychological function of really utilizing the mind, utilizing our cognitive capacity to think carefully, fully, specifically about our experience. So is both the, you know, the fruits of mindfulness, spaciousness, a lot of direct experience, alongside the ability to really engage curiosity. And you see this in the chapter. I think Branchaff describes it really beautifully. There's a real evolution of William's initial reactivity, right? He's basically coming in and he's describing all of these moments of unbearable conflict with his wife, with his stepdaughter, his conflicted feelings about seeing his parents. He gets enraged with colleagues. It's a lot of distress. And Branchaff is basically trying to convey to him that it's okay. Whatever he's going through, Branchaff remains steadfastly curious about it. So in a way, Branchaff is the one initially who's going to hold the capacity to be mindful, right? William doesn't have to do it yet. Branchaff's going to do it. Branchaff's going to say, you got enraged with your stepdaughter. I'm so curious. Tell me more. And then he's going to try to reflect back a fuller understanding of what may have led to the rage or to the conflict. But then slowly, slowly, William is starting to internalize Branchaff's non-judgmental curiosity. He's starting to notice more about what's happening for him with these various players in his life. But without that distorted organizing principle about who he is by his very nature, reducing the complexity of that reflective process. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, couple more words before I shift to my paper. Branchaff also touches on some of the issues that arise with transference and treatment. And he describes William's fear that Branchaff will be displeased with him as he continues to struggle. Right, that Branchaff will be disappointed in him, given his pace, his tendency to default to places of suffering. And Branchaff lays out very nicely that the way a psychoanalyst would want to try to work through that is not just to reassure the patient that they can accept, right? They can accept this person's pace, they can accept their suffering, they can appreciate its meaning. But they would want to explore the origins of the fear, right? That the patient is going to disappoint the therapist, or, you know, not gratify the therapist by nature of their continued struggle. And perhaps draw some parallels between the patient and their initial caregivers and now what they are anticipating will happen with the therapist. And again, not as a way of denying what is authentically happening in the here and now between the therapist and the patient, right? Because these are two complex beings, they're creating something specific to their relationship. But we all bring our history with us, and to some extent, we will all end up transferring on to other key people our expectation of how they're going to respond to us. And in therapy, this is actually a very rich part of the healing process. When patients start to feel the fear or the dread that something by their nature is going to cause them to lose the warm, compassionate, loving connection with the therapist. Yeah. And it's for this reason that therapists were encouraged to orient toward the here and now as much as possible between between the therapist and the patient, even as they're doing this archaeological dig into the patient's history. So lastly, Branshaft would say that a primary way in which we can express compassion to a patient is to help them distinguish their own view of any circumstance from the automatic meanings that were instilled long ago. And this is a radical process, because more often than not, many of us will unconsciously forsake our own authentic experience, forsake our own perception of what's actually happening in order to accommodate views, right? Acceptable perceptions that were internalized long ago. And so Branshaft would say, I mean, this is how we offer people the opportunity to experience aliveness, to really discover who they authentically are, how they authentically feel, what they authentically perceive. Yeah. Okay, so I'm gonna shift into my paper, and then I'll pause, because I would love to hear from you, see how this is sounding. And for those of you who had a chance to read my chapter, you probably were hearing some themes that are resonant with Branshaft and with Bromberg, since I have been so influenced by their perspective. But I also wanted to offer the reader an opportunity to just reflect on what it is we're working with in psychodynamic work. What are the resources, right? Certainly memory is a resource, what the mind is holding and carrying forward. Fantasy, right? The way we're working with our memories, the way we're working with our experience. Our reflections, right, our longings, our associations, all the things. For those of you who have been patients, you know, right, you're really having an opportunity where you're working with the contents of your mind. And we're also working with imagery, right, and the capacity to symbolize experience. And this is extremely important, because since we spend the first couple of years of life pre-verbal, pre-reflective, right, we are finding ways to use imagery in order to express all sorts of strong feelings, all sorts of powerful experiences that we don't yet have the capacity to articulate. So instead, we use images. And this is, of course, true throughout our life, right? This is why our dreams are so important, and our daydreams. Right? These are the ways in which we process our experience. So I wanted to say a little bit about how we can work with imagery as spiritually oriented clinicians. And it has been important for me in my clinical work to utilize imagery that I have personal relationship with and a spiritual relationship with. But in the spirit of really discovering the people that I'm working with, what has been most important is to work with the imagery that arises in their dreams, in their fantasies, right? And this is the part of life that's easy to skip over, right? Especially for those of us who are oriented toward thinking. It can be easy to make too little of healing imagery. And yet, there's a reason why we have recurring dreams. Right? There's a reason why images seem to arrive unbidden. The psyche really does push for healing. Right? This is the extraordinary thing about the human condition. The psyche wants us to feel freed from whatever it is that prevents us from having fullness of living, right? From having a sense of true aliveness. And often we really do need to cultivate more conscious relationship to our imaginative life in order for that to happen. Yeah. So one of the ways I work with compassion clinically is to really try to get to know the specificity of what someone else is experiencing, not only in terms of their reflection, but also their symbolization, right? Their imaginative life. And so we would do this both by exploring dreams as well as daydreams and images that arise in session, especially when it feels like there's something important coming up that can't be articulated. It can only be felt, it can only be represented in some visceral way, often through an image. And so with my patient, we were working with a lot of material circling around loss. She was someone who had suffered early parent loss, having lost her father, and then coming to feel like many children who do suffer early parent loss, prematurely responsible, right? Responsible for the surviving parent, responsible for her siblings. In this case, they were younger, but they're of course children who end up feeling responsible for the entire family system. And therefore burdened, right, with too much responsibility too early in life. And also unsupported in having a grieving process, right, unsupported in consciously mourning the loss of her father. And so when she came into treatment, she was suffering primarily with feelings of extreme depression, really feeling pulled down and out of life, feeling powerfully disappointed by the various players in her life. And I would say feeling consistently entirely on her own, really as if there was no one who would be available to understand her needs and make efforts to respond to them. And so that feeling and that belief became an engine for a kind of chronic, edgy resentment, right? This perpetual feeling that people are always letting her down. They're just not showing up. They are not recognizing her needs. They're not tabling their own. She is the one who keeps things in order. She is the one who provides. And so in the early stages of the treatment, we were mostly just making efforts to try to slowly understand the early roots of this experience that were both informed by the loss, but also informed by a generational and a cultural inheritance that what she should do is simply be extremely competent, work extremely hard, and minimize personal needs, minimize emotional experience, and get on with it. Right, so in a way, therapy was an inherent bind because every session, I'm encouraging her to slow down and feel more and make more room for feeling, which is in and of itself challenging an organizing principle that in life, you work hard, you take care of yourself, and that's pretty much the end of the story. So as I describe, in the midst of the treatment, I suffered a loss. My father died very suddenly. And this really became an opening for us both, in part because I simply didn't have the capacity to camouflage my own vulnerability. I mean, I was able to function clinically, I was holding it together, but I think my sadness, my despair was pretty apparent to her. And so in a way, I think it was opening up a little bit of space for her tenderness, her vulnerability, her sadness, her despair. But interestingly, as I go on to describe in the chapter, she was after me to make more room for my rage and my aggression. And I describe that I noticed the way I was working with my spirituality changing during this time. Right? Initially, I was wanting a lot of peaceful Buddhas present with me. I was wanting Green Tara with me all the time, mothering me, right? Offering just relief. And then I really needed the semi-wrathful Buddhas. I needed some room for the rage. And for those of you who have suffered shocking losses or sudden losses, often there is a lot of rage about it. There's the rage about just being in so much pain, but there's usually also the rage about people who could have prevented the loss and don't. And so I noticed my own internal shifts, both psychological and spiritual. And then interestingly, as I describe in the chapter, my patient started to have these images emerging, both in dreams and in daydreams, where there was this archetypal original woman appearing, who to me had some features of Vajrayogini, very powerful, very present, very capable of cutting through delusions of all sorts. And without having to say anything about my spiritual images, I don't usually unless somebody asks, I felt my patient really actively cultivating more reverence for hers. And her psyche did seem to be offering her these images, right, of basically bodhisattvas who wished to be present for her, who wished to recognize her suffering, because she continued to have some losses. She had some very difficult professional setbacks that felt like they were recreating the early experience of losing something that she desperately needed, and then not having anyone in the system recognizing what's happened. So then feeling abandoned, maligned, right, left to fend for herself. But this original woman kept appearing, kept saying, I'm here. I'll help you do one thing. I want to be present with you. So of course there are many ways we could work with that experience, but what struck me was that it wasn't on me, right, to facilitate this healing process. Of course I wanted to show up, offer whatever I could, right, continue to in some ways translate what I was hearing from her to help her continue to expand her understanding of herself, her life, her history. But it really was her psyche doing the healing work, right? Of course, we all need conditions that support the psyche in doing this work. But the psyche was pushing for this healing. It didn't seem to want her to stop with those limiting, restrictive, burdensome beliefs about the world being against her or being radically on her own. It seemed to want her to access some visceral sense that she is seen. Yeah, that she is recognized by an archetypal presence that can see, that can respond. And it is my hunch, I mean, Jung wrote about this endlessly. It's my hunch, just based on years of clinical experience, that this is the psyche's inheritance. Right, we do seem to inherit these archetypal images from beginningless time. The question is whether or not we have enough support in cultivating conscious relationship to them. And I would suggest, I mean, this is what we do in our spiritual life, right? We have teachers who say, yes, use your imaginative capacity. I'll offer you some images, Manjushri, right, Grintara, Vajrayogini, you name it, Medicine Buddha. But as you do that, see what else is there. See what else is in the psyche that offers you healing. And this kind of reverence for the psyche, I would suggest, is it's the through line of clinical work, right? It is trust that our psyches have what's needed. This is, of course, a belief that's also reinforced in the Dharma. We have what we need to heal from trauma, from loss, from suffering of any kind. We just need the right support in order to access those resources and to allow those psycho-spiritual resources to get more fully woven into life. Yeah. So I think I'm gonna pause there. See how this is sounding. Take some questions.
I have a question. I have a client. You know, you mentioned earlier about this like unconscious fear of rejection or that happens. I have a client who I believe that what is unconscious, like she works very hard to solve her problems and does not allow herself to sit or with or access her feelings for that same reason, I guess, you know, like to fear, like she wants to be good enough to be loved. The process of having that conversation with her, she kind of raises the bar in a way that makes it impossible to like she like is all gung-ho for like working and doing and solving her emotional state. I don't know if I'm being clear that it's kind of self-defeating because it's just she needs more time. She needs to give herself more time. So I guess I struggle with what I perceive to be like the unconscious motivation, but she doesn't allow herself the space to see it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's.
Yeah, thank you, Pat. So it sounds as though she needs some help slowing down in the session with you.
Yes.
Right, to really pause and risk a little more direct experience. Would you say that's
yes.
So? Uh-huh. Okay. And does it feel possible to find ways of asking her if she would be available to pause?
There was one session that where we did like a meditation where she did access some feelings, but it was she very intently like kind of went and like, I am not going to, she put it back on the shelf, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's just difficult. I don't know. I think maybe it might be her. Yeah. It's just difficult to pace it in a way. 'Cause she is very earnest,
mm-hmm.
even in accessing unconscious material, but it's, I don't even really know what I'm asking, but I appreciate what you were talking about because I feel like it's very relevant to this work.
Mm. Thank you, Pat. Well, you know, this issue of pace it's a complicated one in treatment, right? Because more often than not, what is needed is opportunity to just allow for some of the subtler layers of experience to be felt more fully, more consciously. But that will typically feel very risky to patients because what they might access could involve pain, could involve disappointment or despair, or parts of experience that remain pretty well camouflaged. And so it's not uncommon to feel that a patient wants to talk about their experience rather than feeling into it, right? Connecting with the complexity of it on a visceral, affective level. And so, I mean, there are different ways of navigating that. One is to first just make room for where someone is at and what they're comfortable with and reflect with curiosity what you hear them musing on. Another is to also reflect your awareness that, there may be a part that wants to offer details and perhaps another part that isn't so sure what it will be like to feel into this experience with you present. To find ways of just interpreting some of the struggle that you see. Another way is even without a meditation, just to ask someone, would it be all right if we paused here because I'm really struck by what I'm hearing and wondering what it would be like just to make a little more room for what you might be feeling as you're evoking this experience, even somatically. Right. And if it comes with images, I tend to just offer that invitation to associate to the images or sensations so that it's not a guided meditation so much as it's an effort to both slow down the pace and expand the scope of awareness. Yeah. And then of course you can experiment with that because we all have our own way of trying to do that. But sometimes just gently inquiring if it would be all right, to just be together for a few moments given how much meaningful content they're offering and describing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Other questions or clinical material? Jennifer, I see your hand.
Hi, Pilar. My question relates to the case you presented. I hope it's not a too personal question to ask you, but I'm wondering if you could say more about the role of your own vulnerability in treating this particular patient at this moment in your own life. If you felt, you know, resistance to, you know, including that in the space, and also how it felt, or yeah, I guess how it felt for you to, in a certain way, accept care from her mm-hmm. during the sessions.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, thank you, Jennifer. Well, it was a complicated experience for me because I think just by nature of my personality, more so than clinical training, I tend not to disclose all that much about myself. I'm very open to it. If people ask, and people ask all sorts of questions, I think it's important to be direct, to cut through mystery, offer some fellow feeling. So I'm very available to do that when people inquire. But unlike some clinicians who might just, again, by nature of temperament and personality, be more inclined toward some personal disclosing, I rarely do. But there are some patients who are saddled with very edgy fear of loss and abandonment. And so vacations, for instance, would be fodder for anxiety. If they didn't know where I was going, they would suffer. And this patient was, you know, was suffering when she didn't know. So before any break, she would ask me where I was going and why. And I would just be very direct about it. And it was reassuring to her. I mean, on some level, I was including her in my life, but also it meant that, you know, she was less vulnerable to something catastrophic happening and then really having no idea what's going on. And so for this particular, this was supposed to be my summer vacation in August, but my father was having this minor procedure. And so I told her I was going to go see him, and then he and I were going to have some nice time together. And for that reason, when I returned, she walked in and said, "How's your dad?" And I probably could have used a little more time before resuming my clinical work, but I did feel compelled to resume the work, and I just couldn't hide the level of sadness I was experiencing at the time. And I, as I express in the chapter, I worried actually that she would resent me for filling the space with my own despair. And because I think I was mindful of that possibility, and I quickly asked her how my feelings were impacting her, my experience, or just even sharing my experience with her was impacting her, I think she felt sufficiently cared for. But it was interesting for me, Jennifer, to feel cared for by her, right? I did actively feel that it upset her what had happened. And it upset her to see that I was distressed, and she was really wanting to offer me her compassion. And I think it just nurtured, it nurtured a very loving connection between us because I was having a direct experience of her tenderness. And I might not have otherwise. Right. This is the interesting thing about clinical work. I mean, often we're hearing extra transferential experience. And so when something interpersonal is happening, it just profoundly deepens our understanding of who we're in relationship with. So I was able to feel that underneath her toughness, because she could be very tough. I mean, she's really very brilliant, extremely articulate, but also very easily enraged. So it could manifest as a kind of toughness. But really what I was feeling was exquisite, exquisite sensitivity and compassion. Yeah.
Thanks, Pilar.
Thank you, Jennifer. I would also say that in the years to come, when she often would default to a sense of herself as being unempathic. She thought of herself as a tough person. And it was really helpful for me to be able to remind her of how deeply empathic she is. Yeah.
Chi Hui.
Yes. I'd like to repeat two questions. One is, in the process of the therapy, we are trying to get the patients off to feel their, to know their authentic self. And what if this authentic self is sort of in conflict with the patient's current maybe social or family circumstances, that to realize his authentic self will probably cause a lot of disruption, for example, in the family dynamic, or it is something not allowed or taboo sort of thing. So it might help in the clinical space to help the patient to realize his authentic self, but in real life, he's going to get into the conflict if, Secondly, second question is, I'm just wondering, my sense is that a lot of things that's going in the clinical space is still sort of like a lot on, based on this psychodynamics of understanding of processes and what to do to facilitate the patient recovery. I just want, and it seems to me this our spiritual practice and all this is mainly more to equip the therapist's ability to sort of like to be more present and to be more compassionate towards the patient. I'm not sure whether this understanding is correct. That we don't actually use some of these techniques or method that we use during our spiritual practice, like meditation and things like that during the session, but it's more to equip the therapist to be in a better position to be in the space with the patient in the therapy session.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Excellent questions. And in response to your first question, he moved. It's Zoom as though it was an adventure, right? And the configuration changes, but now I see you. In response to your first question, you're absolutely right that risking authentic self-experience is quite risky because it might mean that someone's primary relationships or family system could get destabilized. And this is often a fear, right? That if someone risks relinquishing some limiting beliefs about oneself, that their partner, their children, their parents, the key people in their life will not be able to tolerate those changes, and that they will suffer loss. And so part of the healing process is to explore the fears, what's at risk when they just play out in the fantasy of how their life could change, what could happen, what might get destabilized. And I think you're pointing out that there is a genuine risk, right? There are some family systems that are going to be too rigid or have expectations of someone that are too inflexible to really allow someone to be more fully freed, right? To change to the extent that they need to. Now, sometimes it might mean that something significant will change. They might not be able to sustain certain relationships, or they might not be able to sustain a level of connection or intimacy in certain relationships as they're changing and growing. Sometimes that happens. Other times they're surprised by the give, the give in a family system or in a primary relationship that they hadn't anticipated, or that other people start to change accordingly or in compatible ways. So it's, sometimes it's just a process of more fully understanding the fears and then staying tuned for what actually happens, staying tuned for reality to unfold. Yeah. And in response to your second question, again, I think you put your finger on it, that of course there are many different ways in which spiritually oriented clinicians bring their spirituality into their clinical work. Sometimes they will do it very explicitly through facilitating some guided contemplative work. But more often than not, it's about how the spirituality is being lived, how it's been internalized into the psyche of the therapist, and therefore the environment that they're creating that might facilitate a depth of healing for the patient. And probably most Buddhist clinicians would say central to this is their capacity to cultivate their attention, to listen with presence. And this is still not something that is taught explicitly in most psychodynamic clinical training programs. And it's of course a remarkable absence because what clinicians do is listen. They try to listen with immense presence, with an open mind, an engaged mind, an open heart. It's just that the methods for cultivating that listening capacity are much more bountiful in Buddhist tradition than in clinical traditions. So yes, for me, this has more to do with how I'm trying to be in the session rather than specific practices that I'm offering to patients. I would also just add that it has a lot to do with my understanding of the human condition. So I really have mentioned this before, but I do orient toward the Buddha nature in my patients. I mean, this is what I was getting at in my chapter. I was trusting my patient's psyche. I was trusting her wisdom. I'm going to try to offer what I can, but I'm really there to nurture her trust in her own healing capacity. So the understanding of Buddha nature, the understanding of emptiness, is for me, this is central to how I bring spirituality into clinical work. Thank you, Chi Wei. Max, I see your hand.
Yes, thank you very much, Pilar, for your part too. It was wonderful. And I wanted to ask you more about the part where you mentioned the psyche pushing or pressuring for healing. And there's a lot I'd like to know about that, but maybe just two things. One is, have you had patients that like want to communicate directly with that part of themselves, or is it more something that happens throughout the process and surfaces and imagery and dreams, or can they have like an intentionality towards it and push things along maybe faster because of that? And then the other thing I was wondering is it normal for a clinician to, for their psyche to feel the same like concern for the patient's like lack of fully living? And so would it be normal for like you, for example, to dream of them embodying that like fully living freedom that you described?
Mm-hmm. I'll start with the second question, and then I might, we'll revisit the first one just so I'm understanding you, Max. And yeah, I think any clinician who's really willing to be impacted by their work, who is caring about their patients genuinely, they're gonna hold these precious beings in their mind and in their heart, and they will certainly show up in their dreams. And in fact, I mean, the therapist relationship to their dreams about their patients is a really fascinating part of treatment that I know just a couple people who write about this. It's not talked about all that often, but of course, right? We're gonna be trying to process what's happening, how we are experiencing this person, how we are experiencing their suffering, their longing, their unfulfilled longing. And then the question is, what do we do with that? How do we bring it back into treatment in a way that's most helpful for the patient? And the skillful means here are extraordinarily helpful, because in any healing work, people who are in the mentoring position do need to tolerate what's not yet possible. I think this came up in our last conversation, right? So, I mean, I certainly have worked with many people who are suffering the gap, acutely, between what they're capable of and what they're actually experiencing in life. And so we have to hold that. We have to tolerate that. We have to tolerate the burden of unlived life and stay curious, see if we can't keep exploring what the obstacles are. And in terms of your first question, I wondered if you can give me an example just so I have a better sense of what you're asking.
Yeah, I think what you mentioned for the specific case that you were speaking about was that in the dream, the person felt a visceral sense of being seen by the other. And in this case, it was the like powerful, present female archetype. So I guess like, once there's some awareness of what's happening, like that maybe being seen is part of what's lacking in everyday experience, that could form as some intention towards dreaming or maybe like imagery practices. But my question was mostly about dreaming, where entering into dream time, or however you would like to refer to that, consciously going through that, wanting to explore that more, and then how that results is maybe fruitful for the outcome. And if you've had any experience with that, yeah, I, Does that make more sense?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I certainly encourage everyone I work with to bring in their dreams and to jot down even an image. It doesn't have to be an entire dream. It could be a scene. It could be an image. But to bring that in and to let that part of their experience inform our work. Because, I mean, in the dream researchers, the clinical psychologists who focus on dreams now have really incredible data showing that people with vexing, persistent problems, if they intentionally appeal to their dreaming mind to help them with specific problems, will get the help that they are needing. But they do have to nurture that intention, right? To allow for awareness of what's been dreamt, work with it. I mean, Jung cultivated a practice called active imagination. And I do something similar to that at times with dream images, where basically just bring that image into the room and see if it has something to say, see if it has a function, right? See if it's holding some part of the patient that we could better understand. And this is often the most illuminating part of treatment.
So. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I just squeeze a tiny question in there?
Please, Jerry.
Might play off of Max's question. You were said, we all need conditions to help the psyche do its work. Mm-hmm. Or something like that. And so just top of mind, what conditions come to mind?
Thank you, Jerry. Well, because of our relational nature, we all need another. We need someone. On some level, it doesn't matter what their role is. It doesn't matter if this is a spiritual friend, if this is a therapist, if this is a teacher. It doesn't matter, but we need someone with the capacity to engage with you, right? To let you know that they can make efforts to feel their way into your experience, that you matter enough for them to make efforts to do this, and that your experience is by its nature extremely valuable and begs to be understood by another human being. I think this is just a basic critical human need, and that when we don't have it, we will suffer unbearably. I mean, it's for this reason that COVID has been a catastrophe for some people who have, and maybe you have all felt some of this isolation, right? It really becomes problematic when we feel we cannot find an other, right, who can see, who can care, like who can basically fundamentally get what we're experiencing. So I would say that's the primary condition. And that, of course, would need to be informed by respect, right? I mean, love, compassion, respect, these are just the basic human needs that we have that need to be offered by the other in order for us to work most optimally with our own psyche. And while I do believe in the mystics, there have always been mystics who seem to be able to tap into their own resources so profoundly And perhaps without the same pervasive human need that most of us have for that other, the vast majority of us will need, we need someone else to reflect back to us, to affirm that we have been recognized, we have been heard. And we need to get that, I think, fairly regularly in order to continue working with the psyche. I mean, the Buddha talked about right association. And so he is saying, basically, we need our spiritual friends. We need people who are going to recognize in us what is most valuable, meaningful, precious. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. And maybe I would just add to that, one of the reasons why I do see the therapeutic space as being a spiritual space is that there's an opportunity for people to feel specifically recognized, not generally recognized. It is really not enough for us to be generally seen. We do need somebody to get deeply interested in who we specifically are and have lived through. I would say this is, right, this creates the conditions we need for full living and aliveness.
Pilar, I was fascinated by hearing about, I can't remember the name of the person you were referring to earlier, but because I was just talking to a client this morning who was basically having that exact conversation about how she was second guessing or gaslighting her own feelings because she was living in her mother's narrative. So, you know, it's so important. And so do you have any sort of thoughts about what the nature of that sort of incredible, fierce, bond or need for that, to maintain that attachment is,
yeah.
Other than momentum, I mean, you know, inertia or whatever.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Well, to some degree, I do feel that there is an inherent challenge to being human because of our exquisitely relational nature. I think that precipice of separation or differentiation from the caregiver, even the caregiver who's been deceased for 50, 60 years, right? If you really dig down into that intrapsychic differentiation, it stirs existential terrors of non-existence. I do think that's what it puts people in touch with, to let go of this distorted, archaic belief about self that was internalized from someone else would mean I would be losing myself. And it's really different from I wouldn't know who I am. I think the felt sense is I won't be. So to some extent, it involves accessing that deepest fear and making some room for it, just to see, I mean, is it something that someone could begin to just grapple with or formulate? Yeah.
That's fascinating from the standpoint of the whole meditation on selflessness and, you know, sort of how terrifying it can be to think maybe I'm not what I thought I was, or maybe I'm, you know, maybe that equals I'll be nothing, you know, or I'll be annihilated or whatever.
Exactly. And actually, I mean, Jack Engler and his work, and you know, for those of you who haven't read Psychoanalysis and Buddhism, which was Jeremy Safran's wonderful anthology, Jack Engler has a great, great chapter in there in which he basically revises a paper he had written maybe 20 years before, where he was suggesting a spiritual developmental model that we have to be someone before we're We're softening attachment to self. And then he goes on to say, you know, the Dharma doesn't really examine why we grasp onto ourselves so fiercely. It basically just describes the ways in which we'll suffer if we do. And in that chapter, he says, it seems to him the reason why we grasp onto self is because of the existential terror of non-existence, which is different than impermanence, right? It's different than self-experience changing. It's the deepest terror. He would say it's deeper than the fear of death. It's this kind of existential non-being. So it's worth chewing on to see if it rings true to people. Yeah. So I know that we're going to be winding down. And I did, before we wrap up, I did want to let you know that some of you might have gotten the notice. I'm going to offer a virtual retreat in April on working with anxiety, both from a Buddhist and psychodynamic perspective. So, of course, you'd all be warmly welcome. And if you have any interest, it's April 9 to 11, a Friday night to a Sunday afternoon. Of course, I'd love to see you. So just let me know if that's something you'd like to participate in. And I don't know if we have time for a last word. Joyce.
Yeah, could I ask one question? And I hope it's not too personal and appropriate, but you were talking about your father's loss earlier, and it's just been in my mind since I read your book, wondering where you went to in Scotland, where his, what body of water you chose.
Sure.
You don't mind?
Yeah, sure. Yes, I went to two places. I went to a beautiful place called Holy Island, which is off the Isle of Arran. And there's a Tibetan monastery on Holy Island. So I went there and I basically circumambulated the island. And there were these really extraordinary paintings, Buddhist paintings on the rocks. And so I scattered ashes as I was circumambulating the island. And then I went to the town where my grandmother was born and raised, in Lossiemouth, up near Inverness. So it was a very, very meaningful trip.
Thank you. Beautiful place.
Yes. Thank you, Joyce. So my friends, always a joy and a blessing to be with you. And so I'm so grateful to have this community and that we made it through 1 year of COVID. This feels like a COVID anniversary. I was with Mary and Joe at Tibet House last year. I think the last time I was in a room with a group. So I really just appreciate you all and looking forward to seeing you again soon. Hope you continue to be well, have good health, and a good night.
Pilar, can we ask a question about your retreat?
Sure.
Is it appropriate for clients?
For clients?
We got a question in the chat box.
Is it just for therapists or is it
all? No, all are welcome. Yeah, all are welcome. We'll do a lot of practice. I think it'll be interesting for people who are clinicians, but totally relevant to people who are not.
So. And I think there's some interest. So we'll have to find the link and send it to everyone.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I can send the link to you. And then if you like, you can.
Please do.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. Thank you, Pilar.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks so much for spending this time with us, Pilar.
Absolutely. Be well, my friends.